Government Minister Chris Bishop holds some of the most important portfolios for the new administration: housing, resource management reform and infrastructure. He said housing affordability is arguably the single most pressing economic, social and cultural problem facing the government. His plan is to flood cities with housing opportunities and to open up infill, fringe and more greenfields development. As RMA Reform Minister, Chris Bishop has the final say on council's urban development plans. And also with his RMA hat on, he's one of three key ministers, with Minister of Resources Shane Jones and Energy and Transport Minister Simeon Brown, who can determine the fast-tracking of some major projects. The fast-tracking regime and the extent of powers it gives a select few ministers over projects ranging from mining and aquaculture to wind farms, roads and construction has come under criticism from iwi, environmentalists and interest groups. Housing, RMA Reform and Infrastructure Minister Chris Bishop, good morning. Thank you for your time this morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
You've just been in Europe. Did you see anything there on housing or infrastructure that you might pursue?
Yeah, look, a couple of days in Geneva for the World Anti-Doping Meeting, and then, which I'm on the executive committee for as Minister of Sport, and then 3 days in London. Interesting, really true trip to Crossrail, which is the new Elizabeth line, which goes from basically one side of London to the other. Took a long time to build, but we went and checked it out, and we're interested in exploring in New Zealand some of the mechanisms and tools they use to fund that, in particular, essentially value capture, which is basically making sure that people who live near the train stations or live around the train stations help pay for the development, particularly the developers around those stations. So I think there's a few lessons we can learn in New Zealand for how we do, you know, major infrastructure and major transport projects in particular as well. So it was a really interesting little trip to learn more about that and a few other things as well.
I think that was a concept posited by the previous government as well. When they were talking about light rail, are you thinking about it for light rail or any mode of transport that's opened up?
A bit of both, to be honest. We're obviously not into light rail. We've cancelled Auckland light rail. It was far too expensive and not needed. But we are interested in exploring the concepts around value capture. In fact, we campaigned on introducing them. The way I think about it is you just take it simply. If the government builds a new four-lane state highway, for example, and that unlocks a lot of land or development opportunities around that land or commercial or industrial land, if the government's going to spend a lot of money building that, the people who benefit from that project should help pay for the project. So if you build a four-lane highway, for example, out of Tauranga, as we've committed to do, State Highway 29, for example, a four-lane expressway, that will unlock tens of thousands of houses, and obviously the people who own that land right now will benefit from value uplift. The value of that land goes up because the government's building a four-lane highway next to it. And my view is that those who benefit from that development should help pay for the development. And you can apply that also to things like rapid transit projects, public transport as well. So it depends a little bit on the context, and the tools and mechanisms are difficult, but we've been talking about it in New Zealand for, you know, the better part of 5 to 10 years. Our view, the government's view, is that it's time to push go on some of those mechanisms.
That value capture can happen by means of tolls, or it can happen by means of having higher rates as your property values rise in certain areas. Are you open to the latter?
There's a variety of different ways to do it. You can, tolls is one way to help pay for new roads. We are going to use toll roads to build new state highways as well. Obviously, we've got a very ambitious program of roads of national significance coming back, which Simeon Brown, as Minister of Transport, is leading. So we are going to use tolls for some of those roads. But we're also talking further about value capture. So there's a variety of ways to do that. There's different mechanisms. You can levy adjacent or close by property owners. You can either levy them up front or you can levy them over time. And there's also a role for the Crown to play when it comes to urban development as well. So, you know, one of the things that they did in Crossrail, for example, was when they built the new stations, they did deals with developers around the stations and made sure that people could essentially pay for the privilege of running those stations and helping the development around it. So we're looking at a range of different options. It will depend on the circumstances, but we're doing some work on that right now, and in due course, myself and Simeon Brown will be saying more about it.
Let's have a look at the role you have when it comes to housing at the moment. The powers you've assumed as RMA Reform Minister. Councils are at the gnarly end of urban planning at the moment in several places, and I wonder if we could work through when and how you might intervene, given some recent examples. Could you be specific about when you would intervene as Minister with a council's urban development plans? What's criteria?
So the way the law works at the moment is the councils are, so the last government passed a thing called the National Policy Statement on Urban Development, otherwise known as the NPSUD. It actually started life under the previous national government, and then it got carried through and strengthened by Phil Twyford. And that essentially requires councils to update their district plans to take account of the Policy Statement on Urban Development. So the thing that's got a bit of attention is around rapid transit stations. The councils have to update their plans to allow for up to six-story apartment buildings. And then, of course, over the top of that, you've got the medium density residential standards as well, and the councils have to update their plans for that. Now, we're going to essentially let the councils opt out of the medium density standards, but we're committed to the NPSUD, which is the six-story stuff around city centres and around train stations, rapid transit stops. The law says that it's a complicated process, but basically the councils have to go through the process. They then push out the decisions to a independent hearings panel, which is what Wellington did. And then those hearings panels make recommendations to the councils, and then they have to essentially either endorse the recommendations or recommend their own plan changes. And the law provides that the Minister for the Environment, although I've assumed those powers in my role as Minister for RMA reform, to sign off those plans or to reject them. So in the case of Wellington, that is underway right now. It's been publicly reported the council adopted a variety of recommendations last week. That hasn't actually been formally notified to me yet. That will happen this week, I'm told. And then I will have some time to digest them and take some advice on it. And I'm looking to make a decision towards the end of April on that.
Okay.
There's other councils, that's the Wellington situation. There's other councils in differing stages of the plans. Christchurch, Auckland, for example, Western Bay is and they're going through the process as well. So they're all at different stages, but essentially the final decision maker on those plans is me.
So I'm trying to understand some principles here. Let's use the Wellington City example. The council just voted to overturn many of the recommendations of the independent hearings panel. It actually voted to open up many more areas in the city to greater density. The two parties don't agree. Is that relevant at all to you, or are you only interested in the end in what comes to you from the council, is notified to you from the council?
I will be taking advice on what the council in Wellington has provided to me. It's really important that I don't have a predetermination or a bias around what they recommend to me. I have to consider the issue with an open mind and look at the existing law. They're required to give effect to the law that the government has passed pursuant to the Resource Management Act, which is the National Policy Statement on Urban Development. So I am looking for compliance with that law, and I'll be taking advice in relation to that. I don't have a predetermination.
I understand the situation you're in. So what I'm trying to do,
on the record, as you know, around talking about the importance of zoning when it comes to housing affordability. So that's publicly on the record.
You were on the record saying you want to flood cities with urban development. But when it comes to your decision, is there anything that limits your ability to make a decision? For example, were an independent panel and the council to be in agreement, can you still say, no, that doesn't fit with the policy statement, go back and do more? Is there anything that limits your decision-making power?
I have to follow the law set out in the National Policy Statement on Urban Development. It's not a perfect law. We are looking at one of the things we're looking at this year as part of our housing changes is to simplify and clarify that a bit. So there are some circumstances in which that the law didn't necessarily envisage, and it might be that one of those situations is precisely as you say. So
if those two parties were in agreement and you didn't like what they'd agreed on, currently that would limit your ability to intervene.
It may do, although separating out the existing law from what National campaigned on, which is not the law, if that makes sense. So I've got to follow the law as it is right now. We campaigned as a political party and formed government on the basis that we will strengthen the ability of central government to intervene when it comes to council plan decisions. So it may be down the line this year and maybe going into next year that we will strengthen the ability of central government to approve plan changes because I want to make sure that councils provide development opportunities for housing in their areas.
Okay.
So that's a but that's a separate process, if that makes sense.
It does. So Christchurch at the moment, I think you have said to them, no, I'm not going to pause your independent hearings panel, get on with it. However, you seem to be open to exempting them from the medium density rules. And just for listeners, the medium density rules, as I understand it, this is where you could put up to three properties, up to three stories high, up to three houses, I beg your pardon, up to three stories high on your property without a resource consent, without notifying neighbours. Could you just clarify, are you intending to exempt all councils from the requirement to do that? What's your position?
Yes, that's right. So we campaigned on that, and it's part of our coalition agreement with the ACT Party that we will give councils more discretion and flexibility about the medium density standards. That's a separate issue to the six-story issue, which is the National Policy Statement on Urban Development. So again, that we haven't changed the law yet. So what I've said to Christchurch in relation to your specific example is they wrote to me, and I met with the mayor, and he said, "Look, we're going through our plan change. We're doing the zoning stuff. It's currently before the independence hearings panel down in Christchurch. You've said you'll let us have more flexibility about the medium density stuff. You know, we'd like an extension." What I said to them was, this has been agreed with the mayor, so it's all relatively collegial. I said, "Please push ahead with the six-story rules and zoning requirements because that's a government policy that we will support those. So push ahead with that part of your plan." And when it comes to the three-story stuff, the 3x3, the so-called medium density standards, you can essentially pause that part of the plan change because we will be legislating to make those more flexible for you. And so that's been agreed with the Christchurch Council.
What
So
about
there's quite a degree of legal complexity here, but we're just working our way through and doing it in good faith with the councils.
right? You're anticipating a law change and enabling a pause to enable the law change is what it sounds like to me. With respect to Auckland, years and years and years went into the unitary plan. What is your position on what needs to happen with Auckland's zoning? A big, complex, sprawling city with many issues. And just picking up some numbers, I think these were put to you by Q&A, by TVNZ as well. Demand for the next 30 years estimated at up to 384,000 dwellings. However, an analysis of its existing unitary plan a couple of years ago found it allowed for more than 900,000 of every section were maximally developed. So the question is, does Auckland actually need to do more than its current unitary plan at the moment? What is your view?
So Auckland is more complex. Auckland Council, via Wayne Brown, the mayor, and also the relevant planning councillors, so Richard Hills, for example, have written to me saying that they would like a further extension as to updating their plan. So they've already had one extension. The last government gave them a one-year extension. They would like another year. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is the floods have raised a variety of issues for them that they have to work through in terms of natural hazard protection, and they would like to essentially downzone some areas that have been upzoned. Now, there's complexity that the law, well, their view, I think they're probably right, their view is that the law doesn't allow them to downzone some of those areas when it comes to natural hazards. So they would like an extension for that. And then the other issue in Auckland is that the last round of planning changes didn't take into account the Auckland Light Rail station developments but basically that area was exempted from the upzoning because the last government hadn't sorted out exactly where the light rail stations would go and how that would work as well. So there's a big part of Auckland that hasn't been looked at properly yet. And so that adds an extra element of complexity to it. So the mayor has written to me saying they would like an extension. I'm considering that right now and looking to get back to him very quickly because I know there's a high degree of public interest in that. But in a general sense, in relation to your specific question, Auckland needs to zone for more housing. In particular, I think it needs to go out at the edge of Auckland, and it needs to go up as well. So my attitude to all of this is pretty much as you said in the introduction, which is that we need more density inside our cities, particularly around transport nodes and hubs. We need more brownfields development, so regenerating and redeveloping older sites. But we also need more greenfields. And the reason why the greenfields is really important is that it actually has an effect on price throughout the city. So if you look at the price differential between rural land at the fringe of Auckland and land inside the city that can be zoned, that is zoned for land, there's quite a large price differential. And so the zoning rules are essentially driving value in terms of land price. And that all of that value is just artificially generated value. It's just captured by existing landowners because of artificial planning rules. So I want Auckland.
There's a complication to that argument of going out and up, though, Mr. Bisham. I'm interested in this because we had the Ockham developer on recently making just this point. He's developing the Carrington Hospital site, for example. You're familiar with his work. But his
Yes.
argument is that there's a massive skew towards developments further out, greenfields developments, because the land is cheaper. And he's in town trying to get expensive consents to build buildings near those transport stations, near the city, and wondering, what the hell when big developments are happening further out. And the problem with those big developments further out is that you need transport to them, you need new services for them. Those are costs that tend to be picked up by taxpayers and ratepayers. So have you got the skew wrong in our biggest city?
So our view is that developments on the fringe of city, greenfields land, greenfields development should pay for themselves. So when I talk about growth paying for growth, that's what I mean. So I don't want existing ratepayers to be cross-subsidising new development at the fringe. I want the people moving, essentially the people moving into those developments, to pay for the infrastructure required to support those developments. But it's really important that you don't just draw a ring around Auckland and say, you can build here, but 5 kilometres down the road, you can't build. My view is if the infrastructure costs can be covered for that development at the city fringe, and in some cases they can, and in some cases they can't, but where the infrastructure costs can be paid for and essentially wash their own face and cover their costs, then you should allow that development. Auckland has to grow out to some extent, and it also has to grow up as well. So I seen the remarks from the gentleman in relation to Ockham, and I agree with him to some extent, but I disagree in others.
If
But the
you end up
reality
needing new state
is,
highways, though, and extended train services, and if there's, a new sewerage systems, there's no way that's going to be entirely captured by the purchases of those newly developed suburbs, is there? There is a ratepayer taxpayer
not all of it,
subsidy.
but not all of it, but there are wider benefits to some of those things that the Crown will build as well. So it's a complicated funding system. There's no doubt about that, and we're trying to talk in simple terms. It's more complicated than how we're having the conversation. But at a general principle, if infrastructure costs can be covered by new development, then that should be okay. And the other point I'd make is that the apartments built by Ockham in Auckland cost more because the land price at the city fringe of Auckland is more expensive than it should be. There's quite a lot of economic evidence that the land prices at the fringe essentially suffuse themselves into the rest of the Auckland housing market. And so people pay more to live in apartments in the Auckland City CBD because we haven't got competitive land markets in the rest of the
All
Auckland
right.
City.
Okay.
And that's what I'm trying to solve.
Chris Bishop is our guest. He is the Minister for RMA Reform, Housing and Infrastructure. You're listening to 9 to Noon with Catherine Ryan. It's 26 minutes past 9 on 9 to Noon. House prices, I think you've implied, if not outright said, you want them to get back to being 3 to 5 times household income in the medium to long term. A lot of things going on here. Cost of land, as you've pointed out, construction costs up something like 30, 40%. The interest rates are high at the moment. And so a lot of things factoring into that. I think the current ratio nationwide is just under 7 times household income to average house price, a bit higher in Auckland. My question is, does your modelling suggest you can get to a 3 to 5 times ratio without house prices falling in real terms from where they are now?
Well, I was asked about what my goal is for housing in New Zealand, and my goal is to make it more affordable. And people say, well, what does more affordable mean? And the sort of international best definition is, the international best definition is 3 to 1, actually. And that would be, that would be a considerable stretch. So I've said three to five to one in terms of house price to income ratio. That will involve sustained moderation in house prices, but it will also involve income growth for households as well. So that's what we're trying to get to. And I haven't put a target on it. I haven't said, by 2030 I want it to be X, because that's putting a massive rod for my own back. And frankly, there's so much going on in the housing market. When it comes to construction, when it comes to building consents, when it comes to the cyclical nature of the housing market as well, what I'm trying to do is get the fundamentals right around land supply and around infrastructure funding and financing and around incentives for growth. Basically, the problem in New Zealand is for too long we haven't dealt with the fundamentals. So, we've had schemes like KiwiBuild, we've had a variety of other different programs. We haven't actually dealt with the fundamentals, which is about land supply and about infrastructure. I'm trying to deal with the fundamentals
Okay.
once and for all.
I guess the debate is always around how best you do that, taking into account transport and everything else, and that's where we'll be here all day going over that. But I think you've been, according to my research, I think you've put a figure of something like 10 to 20 years, and there's a big difference between those two. And in principle, do you not want to see house prices fall in real terms? The problem with relying on wage growth alone is that in an environment where we're fighting to keep inflation and therefore wage inflation down, that's going to take quite a bit of time. So,
Yeah,
is it
I'm
in
not.
principle that you don't want house prices to fall in real terms? Is it possible to achieve your goal in anything like the near term to medium term if they don't?
I want sustained moderation. So, house prices have fallen in the last 2 years, for example,
From a
because they
ridiculous
went
peak,
to.
right? They're back to
Exactly. They
roughly
went
where
to a
they were
ridiculous.
pre-pandemic, or actually not, 2021, I think. But carry on.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we basically, the story is during COVID, we printed a lot of money. We had incredibly low interest rates, house prices skyrocketed. They've now come back from what they were, and so house prices have fallen, and the world hasn't fallen in. So I want sustained moderation in house prices, and I want real income growth. And we've got a whole plan around growing real incomes for New Zealanders, which we don't have to get into, but we've got a whole plan around that. And I want to do that in the medium to long term, because that is the only way to solve our
All
housing
right.
problem, is to build more houses and to make housing more affordable for New Zealanders. And
And
there are so many benefits to doing so. There are economic benefits of making housing more affordable.
look, all agreed, but it sounds to me that if you are not going to tolerate further falls in real terms, given how high house prices even were before the pandemic surge, then this is going to take time. Next question, if you would. Let's quickly get, because I'm conscious of your time, let's get to this business of the fast track consenting, which has also been pretty controversial. The scope of these powers in the hands of a small number of ministers is historically pretty out there. I'm not going to bring up the 70s. The last journalist who did that was told he was stuck in the 70s. I'm certainly not. But they are pretty extensive powers. How do you justify them?
Look, there's been a bit of commentary around this. To be honest, it's not radically different to what the last government did with their COVID fast track law. So, the last government put through a law back in 2020, 2021, which listed 17 projects which Parliament endorsed and were automatically sent off to a expert panel to consent. And then most of those projects have been consented. We're essentially doing the same thing. We're saying there will be a range of projects which will automatically be referred to an expert consenting panel to set the conditions and the permits upon which those projects happen, and then the law will also remain in place, so other projects can be used that use the same thing. So
So,
it's not actually radically dissimilar to what the last government did, to be honest.
well, some would argue it would, and it's also been made permanent, and it's also across, the four ministers. It is perceived, in fact, it's more than perceived, it is askew away from a legislative focus for final decision making. Okay, councils might make decisions on consents. If they go off the Environment Court, they go off the Environment Court. Expert advice is received across all issues, all the way through this process. This skews it towards four ministers in the end being able to say, no, not accepting that, go back and remove these conditions or this or that. And not only that, Mr. Bishop, You could argue these ministers have a conflict of interest. If you're transport minister, you want stuff built. If you're in charge of resources, you want mines built. In your case, you want housing development intensified. You're actually almost bringing a conflict of interest to the table, aren't you?
Well, that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is that the government is quite deliberately making sure that development ministers, of which myself and the transport minister and the regional development minister are, quite deliberately making sure that those ministers can try and get things done, build more housing, build more aquaculture developments, build more roads, build more infrastructure. That's precisely the point of the policy.
Okay, so next question.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
I'm just conscious of time again. Where is the check and balance? Because these more judicial processes, if that's where they end up, take expert advice from all and sundry. And how will ministers in the end receive that advice before making some decisions that will carry consequences?
Yeah, there's a whole range of things set out in the bill regarding that. So when applicants apply for a particular project, the officials have to give an analysis to us as ministers as to how, firstly, the project is regionally or nationally significant, whether or not it, there's a variety of things that can't be done. So projects that violate treaty settlements, for example, that is ruled ineligible, and we have, as ministers, to take that into consideration. Then the project goes off to an expert panel, which sets the precise conditions and permits on which it happens, and then it gets referred back to us for final decision making. Again, this is actually kind of similar to what the law already provides for. We're just strengthening it up and making it more relevant and applicable for regionally and nationally significant projects. And we're also doing the one-stop shop nature of it. So the law currently provides for the Resource Management
and the argument that it risks a perceived or a real risk of pork barrel politics. To put it shortly,
I don't accept that. We have to follow the law. So we have to follow the law that Parliament laid out, and there will no doubt be people making sure that we do follow that. But look, we are a pro-development government elected on a pro-development mandate. We want more infrastructure. We want more mines. We want more aquaculture developments. We want more renewable energy. And we're designing a law to make sure we can do that, because it costs too much to do things in New Zealand and it takes too long.
Yeah, the question is whether we've gone from one extreme to another here. Final question, what is going to be on that fast track list? Because without the transparency of something like an approved list of something like 100 projects, without that transparency, it's only going to create further distrust and doubt, isn't it? What is on that list?
Well, I don't know yet, because we're setting up an independent process to advise us on what should be on the list. So in the next couple of weeks, we will establish an expert panel, and then applicants will be required to submit their projects to that panel, and then that panel will provide independent advice to ministers as to what goes on the list. So this is, I think, a good process. It's a clear and transparent process. We'll be taking independent advice from a range of experts as to what should be on the list. This is not just ministers sitting around in their offices, you know, getting an email from someone and saying, oh, yeah, that sounds great, let's just chuck that in the bill, which, by the way, is what the last government did.
All right, forget them, they've gone.
The 17 projects didn't go through a process.
The next question is, what will guide? Will it be cost-benefit economically? Will it balance economy versus environmental or other impacts? Like, what will determine if you decide a project should proceed?
Well, we'll be publishing the criteria for what the expert panel will be considering. But it will be looking at the economic benefits of projects and balanced against the impact on the environment. Some of the projects, it will depend on the particular project, but, you know, renewable energy projects have a different impact on the environment to mining, for example.
All right. A big skew towards economic development relative to the former RMA, well, current RMA legislation, which you intend to reform. Very, very quickly, comment please on Kāinga Ora, which has been in the news this morning. My one question to you is, if there are more evictions, and there will be more evictions because of this change of instruction to Kāinga Ora, to Housing New Zealand, who, if anybody, will be monitoring what happens to children in homes that are facing eviction?
Well, I hope there won't be more evictions. I hope that the effect of changing the policy will be that people comply better with their existing obligations socially and legally to be good neighbours and good tenants. So I don't. I hope there aren't more evictions, but there may be more. That people who break the law and aren't good neighbours will face the consequences of that, and there will be follow up by relevant social service agencies in relation to particular issues that are raised from that.
Well, the issues being the children aren't the ones who break the law, but they face the consequences. So
Well, my message
will part
to
of the
some of these.
instruction be to monitor what happens to households with children who are evicted?
Well, MSD in many cases will be involved in that, and the answer is yes. But as I say, no one wants to see kids evicted from state houses. And my message to people who might have found themselves in that situation is change your behaviour. There is plenty of support available through Kāinga Ora, but also through MSD and other agencies to make sure that you don't get into that situation. So I don't want it to happen. But at the end of the day, if people break their social obligations to be good neighbours and good tenants, there have to be consequences, because the result of not having consequences is some of the mayhem that we see on our streets right now.
Thanks for your time this morning, Chris Bishop, who is Minister for Housing, RMA Reform and Infrastructure.